Good morning. Good morning and welcome to our conference, The Future of Business Law in Mexico. My name is Dean Reuter. I am the Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups of the Federalist Society. And before we begin, I want to offer just a brief word about our organization. The Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies is a group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It was founded in the United States some 30 years ago on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to the U.S. Constitution, and that it is the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. The Society seeks both to promote an awareness of these principles and to further their application through its activities in the United States and, increasingly, abroad. In recent years, the Federal Society has extended its efforts beyond the United States to Europe, hosting major conferences examining the principles above and how and to what extent they operate in Europe. In hosting our conference here today in Mexico, the Federal Society hopes to raise the level of debate about the proper role of government in regulating business as the law continues to evolve in Mexico. For example, how will Mexico's new class action law operate, and what are its most apparent strengths and weaknesses? Does the design of class action litigation generally have an impact on business behavior and consumer interests? And what might this mean for Mexico's economy as it continues to compete in the international arena? In the area of antitrust regulation and enforcement, is there a model that can further both consumer interest and competition among businesses? What lessons, if any, can Mexico take from similar experiences in the United States and elsewhere? In sponsoring its first conference in Mexico, the Federalist Society hopes to encourage debate and discussion on these critical issues. We're going to get to our panel discussions in due course, but first, it's my honor and my privilege to introduce our keynote address. Judge Douglas H. Ginsburg is a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Most lawyers in the United States and most judges in the United States recognize this as the second most important court in our country, second only to our Supreme Court. Judge Ginsburg was appointed in 1986 to the court by President Ronald Reagan, and he served as its chief judge from 2001 to 2008. His undergraduate degree comes from Cornell University, and his law degree comes in 1973 from the University of Chicago School of Law, where he served on law review. Immediately after law school, he clerked on our Supreme Court for the Justice Thurgood Marshall. He served for quite a while as professor of law at Harvard Law School, and he served as a visiting lecturer and visiting scholar at institutions too numerous to name here this morning. But in addition to being one of our country's most esteemed jurists, he served in other important key government positions. Most notably, he's administrator of OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, in the Office of Management and Budget, and perhaps most importantly for our purposes today, as Assistant Attorney General heading the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's going to speak for some 30 minutes or so, perhaps a little bit longer, and then if time permitting, he'll take questions from the audience. So, Judge Ginsburg.
Thank you. Thank you all. it's my third visit to Mexico City on competition matters, all of an academic nature, and it's always been a pleasure to be here, so I appreciate the Federal Society's giving me this opportunity. And I'm going to speak about the evolution of competition law. And although my focus and my experience is in the U.S., I'm trying to generalize beyond our borders. The U.S. started all of this, at least as a matter of statute, in 1890 with the Sherman Act. But from 1890 until sometime in the 1970s, competition law in the United States was essentially incoherent from an economic point of view. And as a result, except for the prosecution of cartels, enforcement was essentially random. New business practices were viewed with suspicion, particularly when they were introduced by large firms, Mergers were blocked without any particular understanding of their likely effects, whether for good or for ill. And indeed, in 1966, one of our Supreme Court justices correctly, I think, observed that the sole consistency in merger cases is that the government always wins, close quote. Beginning in the 1970s, the agencies that were charged with antitrust enforcement, as you may know, we have two, the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, they began, and later the courts as well, to use economic analysis in order to, respectively, for the agencies, decide what cases to bring, and for the courts to review the merits of those cases from with an economic point of view in mind. Today, some 35 years into this, the economic analysis plays a vital role in the enforcement of the laws at all levels in our system. I'm going to discuss the evolving role that economists and economic evidence have in both the antitrust agencies and the courts in the U.S., and demonstrate how the predictability of economic analysis supports a rule of law regime. But I also recognize the difficulties, and I'll discuss them, involved in interpreting and applying increasingly complex economic analyses to the facts of competition cases. Now, countries with relatively young competition agencies and competition laws are in a position to draw on the experience of the United States and other regimes that have had these laws in place for quite a while, both to avoid repeating our mistakes and perhaps emulating some successes. And to this end, I'm going to first discuss the role of economic analysis within an agency and recount its evolving over the decades to suggest what lessons newer competition agencies in other countries might draw from our experience. There are now about 120 competition agencies in the world. In the 1980s, when I was head of the antitrust division in the United States, there was a much smaller number, and we were proselytizing around the world. It was one of the few things the U.S. was successfully exporting, I think, in the 1980s. So there are now, in my view, probably more competition agencies than there ought to be in the world, because some very small countries that probably don't need them or could free ride on others' decisions now have them as well. The role of economists and of economic analysis in an agency designed to enforce competition laws is not predefined. The agencies in the U.S. were born and grew up and perhaps reborn without any economists on staff at all, and little desire to think about economics. Eventually, these agencies recognized the value of doing so. The Federal Trade Commission, after several decades of its existence, first starting in 1914, several decades later, hired an economist. In the 1970s, it had hired about 70 PhD economists on its staff, along with a much larger number of lawyers, of course. The Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice hired its first economist in 1936. That office remained very small until the 1970s and 80s. It now employs about 60 PhD economists. Before 1983, let's say, when the agencies did hire economists, they made them subordinate to the lawyers. In the Department of Justice, for example, the chief economist reported to the deputy head of the division. The deputy head of the division was a lawyer. The head of the division was a lawyer. And the deputy head oversaw the legal staff that investigated mergers and other potential enforcement actions. So the result was that the advice of the chief economist was filtered through a lawyer to another lawyer. And not too surprising, therefore, in 1971, looking at this arrangement, then Professor Richard Posner, long since a judge in Chicago, federal judge, described the antitrust division's economists as, quote, handmaidens to the lawyers and rather neglected ones at that, close quote. And that was generally the situation for that first 70 years at both agencies. The structure in which the economists played second fiddle to the lawyers created a lot of organizational tension, because the economists made their recommendations through the lawyers. The economists were routinely put in the position of trying to explain why a case that the lawyers said they could win nonetheless should not be brought because it lacked economic merit. And so the lawyers viewed the economists as case killers, basically the enemies within their walls trying to subvert their work. And when they took diverging views, as they so often did, the lawyers typically won the debate. Now, there's some theories of bureaucracy that say the larger interest group in the bureaucracy will prevail, and they were by far the larger interest group. Another explanation for the case killer view is that until 1981, the ultimate decision makers were always lawyers. All the commissioners of the Federal Trade Commission were almost always lawyers. The head of the antitrust division had always been a lawyer, and all of them were therefore more inclined to understand and sympathize with the presentation made by the legal staff as opposed to the economic staff. In 1981, when the Reagan administration took office, there was a sea change in the policies and practices of both the antitrust division and the Federal Trade Commission. William Baxter, who was a law professor at Stanford that had taught himself economics and been thoroughly converted to an economic view of the law, became the head of the antitrust division. And James Miller, became the head of the Federal Trade Commission. He was a PhD, and is a PhD economist, not a lawyer. First time in the history of the commission. And there were some other appointments of a similar nature at the commission. I became Baxter's deputy in 1983, and in 85 succeeded him as head of the antitrust division. And as part of an reorganization of the division, which we had to do because the staff had been diminished by 50% over a few years, I elevated the position of the chief economist to be equal to that of the chief deputy, the legal side. And so the economist now had a voice equal at the table with the lawyers. And that has remained in place for the last 26 years. Similar reorganization, similar structuring took place at the FTC and at agencies around the world as the role of the economist was increased. By the 1980s, the period on which I'm speaking, not only were the economists fully integrated into the agencies, but many of the agency's lawyers had been exposed to economics by this time in law school. This was a new thing. The introduction of economics and of PhD economists into law faculties had originated at the University of Chicago just before the Second World War. There they had an economist and a lawyer co-teaching the antitrust case course. And the format was quite unusual. 4 days a week, the law professor would teach the cases and the doctrines reflected in those cases. And on the fifth day, the economist would come in and show why the cases made no economic sense. The introduction of economics into antitrust analysis more than any other subject was thorough. And by the end of that decade, by the end of the 70s, Robert Bork's his seminal work, The Antitrust Paradox, had come out. That was in 1978. And that same year, the first three volumes of the Areta and Turner treatise, which became very influential around the world, appeared, and then two more volumes in 1980. And all of these works integrated price theory and college-level microeconomics into antitrust analysis. All of them were written by lawyers who were literate in economics. Turner was actually Rita's collaborator, was a PhD economist as well as a lawyer. And as a result, these books were accessible to and were well understood by lawyers who had had even a modest exposure, maybe even no prior exposure, to economics. In 1982, the Antitrust Division and the FTC introduced merger guidelines that were more sophisticated than anything that had previously existed. They've only recently been, after a few amendments, only recently been substantially updated. That was last year. And last week, I think it is, the Canadian agency has followed suit with its own variations, and the European Commission as well have all maintained and now revised and updated economically based merger guidelines that state in advance what sorts of decisions, what sorts of proposed transactions they will investigate and possibly block. As the lawyers within the agencies, not just in the U.S., but others as well, but particularly in the U.S., well, as they became more comfortable with economic analysis of in antitrust law, they became less resistant, of course, to the recommendations of the economists. So having once been viewed as case killers, the economists came to be respected by the lawyers because their work had become highly relevant and indeed essential in the final decision of whether to challenge a merger or to bring a case of any sort. Today, both the U.S. agencies and several of the major agencies around the world make it a practice, and I'm not sure whether someone can tell me whether this is true in Mexico as well, make it a practice to assign at least one economist to every matter as soon as the file is opened, as soon as an investigation has begun or a case is contemplated, so that we don't spend a lot of time developing a legal case that doesn't make a lot of economic sense. Well, different countries have organized their systems for antitrust enforcement and for judicial review in different ways, of course. But regardless of the structure that they've created, the newly created agencies around the world are at, as I said, a distinct advantage in that they can profit from the unfortunate history of antitrust enforcement in the U.S. and some of the earlier jurisdictions, the other earlier ones. In particular, it's easier for an agency to integrate economists and economic analysis into its work during its formative years, before bureaucratic interests have evolved and taken place that will resist that kind of a change. Nonetheless, this takes place within a larger legal culture, and the introduction of economics is everywhere somewhat alien to the pre-existing legal culture. I think more so in civil law countries than in common law countries, but everywhere it is nonetheless something of an alien way of thinking. I think most observers would agree that it would be peculiar for an environmental agency not to employ an environmental scientist, or many of them. And it I think when the argument is laid out, it should seem equally strange for economists not to play a central role in the work of a competition authority. Competition was, after all, an economic concept long before there was a competition law or a competition agency. Now, the integration of industrial organization economics, that's what we're talking about, into the work of a competition agency raises questions about the internal organization of the agency, which I've mentioned, as well as some questions about how it exists in the larger legal law culture. In the last decade or two, it's become essential that the agency have both economists and lawyers that are also learned in the fields of intellectual property and intellectual property rights. Scientific and technical developments in the industries of pharmaceuticals and particularly digital electronic industries have spawned a host of new and thorny issues for competition policy. Advances in digital technology and the growth of the internet have significantly altered the competitive landscape And in those other, in a lot of other related industries, including most obviously newspapers, book publishing and distribution, motion picture distribution and exhibition, musical recordings, and general retailing. Indeed, few if any really sizable industries have not been affected in some competitively relevant way by the revolution in digital technology. Dominant firms have emerged in markets with significant network effects, and in some there's been a succession of dominant firms, competition being rather competition for the field more than competition within the field. And that has ambiguous implications for competition policy and for the underlying economics. To give you a familiar example, 3 or 4 years ago, we would all say MySpace was the leading social networking platform in the world. 3 or 4 years later now, it's obviously Facebook. They're not interconnected. MySpace has something like 8 or 10% of the subscribers that Facebook has. So you may see in this industry, because of network effects, a succession of dominant firms, each one of whom is possibly without any market power because of the potential for entry displacing it rather quickly if it exercises that power to disadvantage subscribers or consumers. Now, competition agencies around the world are not of one mind about these developments, but they're in almost constant dialogue through the International Competition Network, the European Competition Network, a variety of other arrangements among these government agencies, in part because agencies in multiple jurisdictions now are called on to analyze the competitive implications of the same transactions, the same mergers, the same joint ventures, the same business practices, and the same dominant firms operate across the world in many different jurisdictions. From the firm's point of view, it's a headache of complying with and filing applications with or possibly being investigated by a large number of agencies. From the agency's point of view, it's a coordination problem so that there is not an unnecessary duplication of efforts and the results are reasonably consistent around the world. Nonetheless, each agency finds it necessary in many instances to do some of its own original work because the market participants in that agency may be in that country, pardon me, or jurisdiction such as the EU may be different than the market participants in another geographical area, and so the analysis of the effect of the transaction, the joint venture, the business practice may differ from one jurisdiction to another. The economic analytic capacity of a properly staffed competition agency is also a resource with the potential to improve decision-making throughout the government, of which it's a part. Indeed, it's long been my belief, and it was my experience in running the antitrust division, that the competition agencies can often make a greater contribution to consumer welfare through advocacy within the councils of government than they can through enforcement of competition law in the private sector. Not that they should neglect the latter, but because governments typically make decisions totally without regard to their anti-competitive impact. Designing specifications for large procurements, for instance, in such a way that there are one or perhaps two or three bidders that are qualified, where the specifications could have been broadened in such a way as to allow a larger number of competitors without compromising anything important to the agency during the procurement. Every department and agency of the government, of every government, of course, has its own mission, and it's rare indeed for one of them to consider whether a decision that it's contemplating might better serve the public if it were altered in some way to be less anti-competitive. By the way, in Korea, the Korean Fair Trade Commission, which is their antitrust agency, is a cabinet-level agency, and it has the ability and the responsibility to object to government decisions taken by other departments or agencies when they're proposed if they would have anti-competitive effects. So that gives that agency a uniquely important degree of leverage within its own governments. But in the United States, the agencies file comments with regulators, sectoral regulators. The Department of Justice, the Antitrust Division, routinely comments before the Department of Transportation on airline mergers, on airline alliances, and other transportation issues with competition significance. The Federal Trade Commission routinely offers its opinion unsolicited to state legislatures that are contemplating restrictive practices such as more occupational licensing or requirements that constrict a market without benefiting consumers. A recent example is the Federal Trade Commission's attempt to or advice to state legislators that legislatures that have prevented the sale of caskets by anybody other than funeral directors, thereby preventing Walmart and other mass merchandisers from selling cheap caskets. Totally unnecessary special interest legislation, anti-competitive, and the Federal Trade Commission makes an effort to embarrass the legislatures when they are contemplating these things. Well, not to embarrass them, but to bring out the implications which should embarrass them. This is also true in terms of environmental regulation, where there's room for competition in terms of markets for emission control, so-called cap and trade programs, some of which have been extremely successful, and which might not be thought of by the regulatory agency without some input or consulting, if they do want to do it, from the from their brother competition agency. It's not enough that the agency deciding, the competition agency, deciding whether to challenge a merger or a business practice as anti-competitive is an expert in economic analysis. It also, the agency also, has to be able to defend its decision ultimately in a court before a judge or judges who are unlikely to have access to an economist and are unlikely themselves to be experts in competition law, let alone price theory. Now, in a simple cartel case, the evaluation of economic evidence is not ordinarily necessary, except perhaps at the damage phase. Well, I guess usually at the damage phase. Because a cartel is in most jurisdictions unlawful regardless of any supposed economic justification or other justification that it may offer, cartel cases are not significantly different from any other charge of a civil or criminal conspiracy to violate the law. But the picture becomes considerably more complicated when one considers even a simple merger, and still more complicated when the case involves a case in court involves a charge of attempted monopolization or abuse of a dominant position. The investigation of a merger between firms that are in direct competition will typically require an evaluation of their market shares and, if they're deemed significant, of the dynamics of the market or markets in which they compete. These investigations can entail gathering price and cost data that not only from the merging firms, but also from other firms in the market. It may entail interviewing customers about their choice of suppliers and how they would be affected by the proposed merger, investigating whether there are high barriers to entry into the market, and interviewing potential entrants. If the merging parties are large firms, then they may compete in many separate product markets, and each of which will have to undergo some investigation. Economists will have to analyze the data that are collected and will have to advise their legal colleagues whether the proposed transaction is adverse for consumers, as expressed in likelihood of higher prices or lower quality or a slower rate of innovation or some other dimension. If the agency decides to block the merger and the parties seek review of that decision in court, then the agency will be submitting to the court an evidentiary record that's replete with economic data and analyses, as well as a legal argument about why the effect of the merger would violate the applicable legal standard. In all but a very simple antitrust case, the reviewing court is going to face and does face a difficult task. So even if the court is specialized in the review of competition cases, and there has been an emergence of specialized tribunals over the last 25 years, it's unlikely to have at its disposal the same quality and quantity of analytical resources as the competition authority has, and probably even as the private parties have. If it's a general court that hears all manner of cases, as is true in the U.S., and is almost certainly, then that court will almost certainly not have the assistance of even one staff economist. And nor will the judges be familiar with the economic concepts about which the competition agencies and the firms are arguing. In these circumstances, de novo review, starting over review by the tribunal, is almost certainly impractical, and it almost is never expected or required by the courts, by the legal charter governing the court's review. On the contrary, the reviewing process will be undertaken with some significant degree of deference owed to the factual findings and perhaps to the legal interpretations offered by the enforcement agency. So the issue before the courts will not ordinarily be whether the proposed transaction or the allegedly unlawful conduct is in fact anti-competitive, but rather whether the competition agency has made a sufficiently plausible case that is anti-competitive and harmful to consumers. Most cases worthy of pursuit through the courts are going to be close cases, and they're made particularly difficult by the sophisticated lawyers and the expert economists that are employed by both sides. In addition, because the economic stakes in an antitrust case are often very significant and sometimes huge, the defendant in the case is going to find it worthwhile to invest heavily in the defense of its position. The challenge facing the court as a consequence should not be underestimated. Even when the standard of review is deferential, sorting through and making sense of technical evidence is a painstaking and intellectually daunting proposition, particularly for a generalist judge. That means that the task facing the lawyers presenting the case is also vexed, because they have to appeal, they have to make their position understandable to both the intellect and the intuition of the decision maker. Agencies that repeatedly appear in court in order to defend their enforcement decisions become pretty skillful in this type of presentation. But no amount of economic evidence is going to persuade a court unless it's presented by the lawyers in a way that is understood by the judges and fits the governing statute and precedents and traditions of that court. For this reason, it's imperative at the stage of judicial review for lawyers and economists still to work hand in hand, whether on behalf of the competition agency or of the interested companies, in order to make a presentation that's both intellectually honest and potentially persuasive to the judges, who are sure to be well trained in the law and almost certainly not in economics. Now, the role of economics in the U.S. courts has sort of mirrored the experience within the agencies. The Supreme Court, as I mentioned, ignored economic analysis for many decades, but then it wholeheartedly and rather suddenly embraced it with the help of the antitrust agencies. And in recent decades, at least the last 20 years, the court has become particularly receptive to economic arguments and has been willing to overturn several long-established precedents that conflicted with the teachings of modern economics. Go back to 1960, after 70 years after passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Supreme Court still didn't have a coherent understanding of competition, and hence of competition law, and neither had economists for much of that period. And so the court interpreted the statute according to various social and political goals, such as protecting small businesses from their larger, more efficient rivals, or mitigating the effects of competition on producers during the Depression, when competition was thought to be depressing prices. And here's what the court said as late as 1961, quote, "We cannot fail to recognize Congress's desire in passing the statute to promote competition through the protection of viable, small, locally owned businesses. Congress appreciated that occasional higher costs and prices might result from the maintenance of fragmented industries and markets. It resolved those competing considerations in favor of decentralization," close quote, 50 years ago this year. In the 1960s, there came to the fore this generation of legal scholars who had learned largely by their collaboration with economists to apply economic principles to antitrust law. I mentioned Phil Arita, Don Turner, Robert Bork, Richard Posner. They advocated an interpretation of the antitrust laws that promoted efficiency in the form of consumer welfare. And a decade later, the Supreme Court adopted economics as the single way to interpret the antitrust laws. And since then, it has systematically revisited its decisions to bring them into alignment with modern economic understanding of competition. The first major milestone was in 1977 in the GTE Sylvania case, which involved a manufacturer and a retailer, and the manufacturer insisted, had a clause in the contract governing distribution that limited the retailer to a small geographical area, could not move its shop or open additional stores. And the court held that non-price vertical restraints, such as those territorial restrictions, would no longer be condemned per se, would be subject to a rule of reason inquiry. And that entails a close examination and a balancing of the likely pro and anti-competitive effects. And in doing that, the court overruled its own decision of only a decade earlier. By 1979, 2 years later, the court embraced a broad understanding of the act as being inconsistent with much of its own prior teaching. In the case called Ryder against Sonitone, it said that the legislative history of the Sherman Act, quote, "suggests that Congress designed the Sherman Act as a consumer welfare prescription," close quote. It took that directly out of Bork's book. So there was a revolution in a very short period of time. From Sylvania and Sonitone, those two cases forward, the court's antitrust jurisprudence, which had once been ad hoc and lacking in any consistent understanding of economics, began consistently to follow some simply stated legal norms drawn from, or at least consistent with, contemporary understanding of price theory. The trend in the court's adoption of economic principles is clear from its citation practices. Over the last 40 years, it's gone from citing economics sources in 30% of its opinions, antitrust opinions, to doing so in 77% of its opinions. Once the court abandoned its concerns with social and political goals, the scope of antitrust liability narrowed very considerably. The court now condemned only those transactions and practices that economic analysis showed to be inimical to consumer welfare. Gone was the concern with the welfare of producers. Gone was the concern with small firms that could not compete against larger and more efficient rivals. And the result was a much more predictable jurisprudence with a high degree of agreement among the justices. By the end of the most recent decade, 85% of the competition cases were decided by a majority of six or more justices out of nine. All of them, without exception, favored the defendant. The previous decade had been much less pronounced, and this grew over a period of time. So it's not surprising when one considers that thoughtful observers are more likely to agree when asked whether asked whether a practice is harmful to consumers than they are when they're asked to agree whether a practice is desirable from a social or political perspective. So a merger, for example, between retailers that produces efficiencies of scale that's likely to result in lower prices is clearly good for consumers. But if the result is that locally owned stores go out of business, then it may seem less clear whether it's good for the community overall from a sort of cultural point of view or an exercise in city planning. But that's not competition law. Predictability and certainty are surely virtues in a rule of law regime. The contribution that economic analysis has made to advancing those values really should not be underestimated. Embracing economic evidence allows decision makers to apply a coherent system to each case and enables private parties better to predict what the court would do and thus avoid litigation, unnecessary and losing litigation. Now, at the same time, it would be misleading or a mistake to think that economic analysis invariably indicates how a particular case should be decided. On the contrary, a complex and novel or novel antitrust case can engender genuine disagreement among disinterested economists on the competitive implications of the conduct that's at issue in the case. And indeed, some recent cases in the U.S. Supreme Court have prompted various academic economists to submit opposing briefs. These are academics with no stake in the matter, they're not being paid, to submit friend of the court briefs on different sides of the same economic issue. But once the law is closely tethered to economic analysis, it becomes a matter of concern that the law itself not be made uncertain by rapid changes in economic thinking. It's neither practical nor consistent with the rule of law for courts to decide cases based upon the latest theory or the latest empirical study that appears in the latest issue of an economics journal. To be sure, the law must take account of changes in the scientific disciplines on which it relies, but courts should not be relying upon a new theory or empirical study that has not yet been generally accepted in the relevant scientific community. The Supreme Court made a related point, incidentally, in the Daubert case involving expert witnesses when it reminded us that, quote, scientific conclusions are subject to perpetual revision, close quote. The challenge is for competition agencies and likewise reviewing courts and therefore antitrust counsel to incorporate into their thinking, their decisions, their review, and their briefs, in the case of the lawyers, new but generally accepted developments in economics without creating uncertainty or impairing the agency's or the court's legitimacy as an interpreter of the law. One other problem, and I'll close with this. The dynamic and increasingly mathematical nature of modern economic techniques that are now used by competition agencies and the consultants in litigation pose another problem for the rule of law for which there is no obvious solution. How is a court to determine whether a competition agency has acted arbitrarily or on the basis of inadequate evidence? One possibility is to make sure that the judges are educated to some degree in economics. And although I firmly believe that a basic economic understanding is useful for every judge, but especially for judges deciding competition cases, I do not think it's practical to expect judges, as they're currently educated and selected to become judges, that they be proficient with contemporary economic tools such as econometrics. That's not to say that the judges shouldn't be expected to know basic economics at the level, perhaps, of an introductory college-level course. But one should have modest expectations for their degree of facility by any person who has made a career decision many years earlier in favor of the law and not of a technical field. So to the extent that evidence of reliance on economics creates these challenges of change and complexity, the case for specialized courts becomes more compelling. In the United Kingdom, appeals from the Office of Fair Trading are heard by the Competition Appeals Tribunal, or CAT, which is widely regarded as a very successful institution. They have a panel consisting of a judge and two qualified laymen who may be economists, accountants, statisticians, or others with relevant background. And the work of the CAT's been admirable and stands in really stark contrast with some of the decisions of the European Court of First Instance, a general court that reviews decisions brought by the European Commission. Another possibility is to appoint one or more economists to serve as a judge on each multi-member panel reviewing a competition case. And this is what happened in France. Frédéric Genis is an economist, not a lawyer. He sits on the Cour de Cassation, which is the Supreme Court for these types of matters, and participates alongside the more traditionally qualified judges, and I think has a great deal to contribute as a result. The risks of economic analysis becoming more mathematical and even more difficult for judges to understand are two. For courts incorporating economics into competition law. The first is that it may require judges, not only generalists, but also members of a specialized tribunal, to evaluate evidence in a framework where they are not as adept and not comfortable. And second, it may lead judges to defer too much to agencies whose decisions they review and enforce, much as the Supreme Court used to do, as I said, when it was observed that the government wins every case. All I can suggest is that judges confronting economic evidence couched in mathematical terms consider the view of Professor Ronald Coase, a Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago, under whom Professor Priest and I both studied. He was a member of the Chicago Law Faculty, although not a lawyer. During his long tenure as editor of the Journal of Law and Economics from 1964 to 82, he would not publish an article that relied upon mathematical notation on the ground that an author who could not express himself in ordinary language probably did not know what he was talking about. So I commend that lesson to the bar and to the agencies and to the bench. We have a common problem, and it'll take us a while to see how best to deal with the complexities that have been introduced along with the greater certainty that's been brought to this field of law by economics. Thank you for your attention. Do we have any time? Two questions? Okay.
Why don't we extend the time of this presentation briefly, and then we'll have a shorter break, but let's take one or two questions if folks in the audience have questions. We have handheld microphones. We're taping the event, so in the back there. Yes, sir. Is there a microphone for this gentleman?
Hi, good morning. I was very interested in your recommendation for judges to be more educated in economic matters. And in Mexico, we've been experiencing some litigation and some criticism from both the society and other groups, as well as political parties and politicians, regarding the decisions taken by the regulatory agencies. Would you recommend politicians to be also trained somehow in economics for them to be more aware of what agencies are doing?
I think there's some law of physics that presents that. That would be very desirable, but it seems to me unlikely to be something we can bring about. But it would certainly have prevented much, if not most, of the legislation in the United States on all subjects.
Better training. Another question from the floor. Yes, sir, right here. And we'll make this our final question, then we'll have a short break before we assemble our next panel.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you, what's your position on, because this is a recent development in Mexican law, about specialized courts, having a single court that is has to deal with everything regarding antitrust and all would go to that specific court. Is that, you think, a good idea? Would that court tend over time to become, to lean more on the agency side? What's your position on that?
Well, the performance of the Competition Appeals Tribunal in the United Kingdom has been, which is a specialized tribunal, has been very good. The judges do not stay there for life. They come for a term and then go back to a general court, which may be a good model. The introduction of laymen on the panel, along with judges, laymen who are experts perhaps, or at least more knowledgeable, may also be a good idea. There's an empirical study in the United States of the outcomes in antitrust cases, of cases handled by judges who had some mid-career economic training and those who did not. And the judges who had had some, who had taken an economics program for judges, were reversed less often on appeal. There was some other measure they used to indicate that they seemed to have a better understanding of these competition cases. So I think whether it's education or specialization or a combination of the two, these are ideas worth exploring in each jurisdiction.
Terrific. Well, Judge Ginsburg, thank you so much for your time today and your remarks and your thoughtful comments. Let's take a very brief, say, 10-minute break and while we assemble our next panel, but please join me in thanking Judge Ginsburg for being with us today.